Someone else probably. Okay, so. I think I'm good. So, this is a song that I wrote probably. I'm going to say 30 years ago. So thankful for the rain. Living water, I called and you came and you knew what I needed. Living water, you drenched my thirsty soul. Living water, you were more than I, you were not just enough, you were more than I longed for. And I'm so grateful for the rain. Droplets on the pond, splashes on the ground, tears falling from the cloud. You heard my cry. And you had to come. You could not leave me dry. Living water, I called. You came and you knew what I needed. Living water, you drenched my thirsty soul. Living water, you were not just enough, you were more than I longed for. And I'm so grateful. Living water, called and you came and you knew what I needed. Living water, you drenched my thirsty soul. Living water, you were more, not just enough, you were more than I longed for. And I'm so grateful. You know that I would just die unless I satisfied. You know that I would just die unless I satisfied. my thirst. You knew that I would just die in the sight, satisfy my thirst. Living water, I called and you came and you knew what I needed. Living water, you drench my soul. Living water, you were not just enough. You were more than I longed for. And I'm so grateful for the rain.
Thank you.
Sure. I don't sing anymore without doing extensive warm-up, so I'm glad I made it through without choking or something. And you know what? You all are welcome to our church sometime if you want to come by. It's 821 State Street in the loft there, and there is an elevator if it's needed. Because it's upstairs, and we're there Sundays at 9 till about 10:15. Thank you. New Covenant Church. We can be Googled. Yeah. So, floor is open. It is. It's good.
Thank you so much for that. That was beautiful. Made me cry. And speaking of crying, can you hear?
Hello?
Maybe they can't.
Speaking of crying, we have just finished watching the Ken Burns The West. It's a documentary on the settling of the West. And the settling of the West was very unsettling for me. And not that somewhere inside I didn't know what it was about, but entering into that well-done documentary, I feel like I began to see kind of what's established our country, which seemed to me was greed. And so taking, you know, the Indians and their land and the buffalo and their history and having there not be any room for that. Then the Hispanic, who actually had settled in many parts and contributed wonderful things, fought with. You know, it's just the gold rush, the all of that. I just realized this is a foundational thing in our life. Is greed in my life. And so I don't know if you have any words to say on that, but it's right for such a time as this awareness, you know, you just don't know exactly where to go from here. But it's disturbing.
Well, yes, and Ken Burns is the kind of mind I also respect, because he doesn't play by institutionally established rules either. Mm-hmm. He asks questions. It's the question askers that I find are life-giving. And And so that's not the only thing he's covered, but more recently, the West, which I have not seen, but I've read about these things and experienced some. One book that I find important is Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz's An Indigenous History of the United States. Latinos, they experience a different kind of racism from African Americans because they're part white. And nowhere in Latin America was there ever a banning of interracial marriage. So I'm not saying there's no white supremacy there, but it's different. So when they come here, or when they grow up here, as the case may be, they experience a pushing back to their very identity when they know the continents better than anybody else. And yet they're mistreated for it. We need to take a close look. I was at Westmont College a week ago, and I said, look, just travel with me. Let's go back 500 years. And you're indigenous to these continents, to the Western Hemisphere, I said. And how are you seeing things play out? They're sending their murderers and their rapists, some of whom are very kind, good people, I assume. But, you know, it's easy to forget history and to create our own history. So I don't know if you have anything specific to address. I just, you know, the Westward. You know what? I was in Ferguson, Missouri several years ago, and an activist I wanted to learn, and I took him out to lunch. And this is in St. Louis. You know, Ferguson is just basically an extension of St. Louis. And so we were in St. Louis, and I asked, so what do you think would have to happen here to begin the end of racial dominance? And he said, well, we'd start by removing that arch. Yeah, he was talking about the Gateway Arch, which basically, gave it away, legitimated westward expansion, manifest destiny, all of the above. And so he said, yeah, because we won't have a reckoning until we deal with our monuments, because we tend to not necessarily take pride in, but we become dismissive of true history when we have monuments around us without explanation.
Yeah. So any suggestions of what one could do to take other steps? Other steps.
Well, the first thing that comes to mind, and you got to realize this is my mind, so.
That's okay. That sounds good.
There's. I wrote a book. In 2017. Some of you know about it, huh? And I know Maureen does. She was one of the first recipients. I gave her a copy back. Did I? Yeah. And it's called Making America Great Again.
I think I've heard that somewhere.
That's where he gets it from. No. No, Making America Great Again, A Challenge to Christians and an Appeal to the Global Community. So,
great. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks.
It is on Amazon. The last I checked, they had run out of paperbacks. There are hardcovers and Kindle, I'm pretty sure. And I always carry a few in my trunk.
Hi, I'm Gloria, and thank you so much. I'm glad you were here, and I always say that to people. Yeah, like an ice cream cone. Anyway, thank you so much. It's been very eventful, and I loved your singing. You know, they say we're here as a community, and you like protesters? Okay. I get a lot of news, and I really come here to be community. Not about you. I just think this is a place to be safe. this is a place to be safe. And your father was in the Navy as a photographer. Did you travel around?
Just in California. He traveled a lot of places, but he didn't take us on the ships that went to Japan and Vietnam.
Right. So he was in Vietnam and Japan. And my father was a Air Force pilot in China, Burma, China. So there's another part of our history, too, that we sometimes forget, about freedom and who fought for our freedom. And so I just wanted to bring that out because I know I miss my father a lot, too, and because he was fighting in two wars. So the Korean War wasn't a war, it was a conflict. Still is a conflict, as a matter of fact. But I think we need to honor all people, not just one group or another. We're all individuals. We're all human beings. Thank you.
I agree we should honor all people. Some institutionally kind of get that admiration, would you say, more readily than the ones who break the rules? The ones who keep the rules are more likely to get admiration. Not always, but they often do.
Thank you so much. I grew up in St. Louis, across the river, in Illinois, and I moved here to go to school when I was 25. And I was shocked when I moved here because there is latent African-American racism that I grew up in. It is latent. It is horrific. And when I moved here and I was looking for a place to live, my uncle, I was staying with my aunt and uncle in Montecito, and I was looking for a place to live, and I'd go somewhere, and my uncle would say, "That's a bad neighborhood. You can't live there." And I'd say, "What? No, it's really nice." And he'd say, no, that's probably not a good neighborhood. And then what I started noticing was the racism and the scapegoating on Hispanics, because we don't have a high African American population here. And what
it's
I noticed
gone down, right? You know.
Well, what I noticed was it was the same thing. It was very similar. Not exactly, but really similar. And what I learned and observed firsthand was that it had to do with rural, suburban, and urban. That I saw that it broke down in those lines, that people had to, they always had to have a scapegoat. Everybody had to, it seemed to me that they had to have somebody to be better than, or the reason why, or whatever. But what I saw is there was an interchanging ideology that wasn't specific to a particular ethnicity. It was just that need to oppress, dominate, and be better than. And it was shocking. And I take my daughter back to visit St. Louis, and I noticed that she would say to me, like when she was three in the car, "Mom, let's play the bad neighborhood game." Now, I had never really talked about bad neighborhoods or something, but, you know, this was no GPS or whatever. But that even as a child, she wasn't raised with anything, but she knew to look to the outside, to look to the poverty levels, the all the different kind of symbols. And I was so shocked. And now when I think about what's going on in our country now with the divisions, I mean, it's kind of, in some ways, urban, suburban, rural, educated, you know, a lot of different factors. But, and I don't know what we do with that. I mean, I moved to California because I just couldn't handle it anymore. And and I never moved back. I visited and I shielded my child, and, you know. But anyway, any comment about that kind of, do you understand what I'm referencing?
I think I
referencing?
Kind of get, because of the history that you mentioned. You know, I came here in 1972 as a college student, and there were more African Americans here. When real estate went up in value on the east side, they sold and they moved other places, many of them. And But they were the service community here. They were the housekeepers, domestic workers, hotel linen changers, janitors, gardeners. And that's been replaced by the Latino population. So that contributes to the divide. You know, it's me sitting at, I said Casa Serena, I meant Casa de Maria.
Yeah.
It's me sitting there being treated in a way that I'm not comfortable just accepting, but it's real. The religious leader who has been here and actively serving the longest in town is a black pastor by the name of James Ficklin. He kind of stays quiet. But about, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago, and he's been pastoring for 52 years. He came here from Mississippi, and he lived here for 3 years and then became the pastor there. And he remembers the time when there was an unofficial boundary where, I think it was Santa Barbara Street, where African Americans who lived on the east side could not come any farther. And so about 6 or 7 years ago, another pastor who is not in town anymore took him out to lunch on State Street. And he said, "This is the first time I've ever been on State Street." And it was kind of a stunner for the other pastor. And he said, "Well, you know, when I came here, we weren't allowed to be here. And I just never developed a desire to go somewhere where I wasn't welcome."
My son feels the same way. He's a mixed race Negro, and he said the other day, he's constantly, for the last 10 years, he's gone to Brazil. And the reason he's in Brazil is because he feels more comfortable. There are beautiful people in Brazil, and they are all different colors. But here in Santa Barbara, and I'm sorry to say, I have lived here most of my life, and the Negro population is very, very separate and small. And I'm sorry about that, because it's a rich culture. But thank you for coming today.
Thank you.
I have a pretty long association with Santa Barbara, having come here with my parents in the mid-50s. And when we came, of course, my dad had retired, and I just got out of high school, and we wanted to buy a house. So the realtor showed us around, and he said, "Well, you know, there's a lot of Latino people." I don't know what they call them, Mexicans in those days or whatever. He said, "You know, we can't discriminate against them, you know. I mean, they're different, but, you know." So, I mean, you could see right away that there was this animosity. And then when we bought our house, you know, we had no problem, but I thought later, gee, it's too bad that a lot of these other people, like Japanese and Chinese and that, could not buy this place, you know, at that time. And so that was kind of sad. I'm happy we got it, but then maybe we were a little privileged that way, you know, being white, but we were not from the area. We were from Chicago, a different place altogether. So, well, it was something else I was going to say, but I can't think of it, I guess. But, oh, one more thing, yeah. I don't know if you knew Reverend Pat. But she had a choir here for many years, mm-hmm. and she was a real bridge builder,
yeah,
as a black person. I was in her choir for a while. It was just wonderful, and I'd like to honor her as an exceptional, really wonderful person that lived here for many years and, you know, broke the ice between the races, I think. Thank you.
Mama Pat. Thank you.
thank you, along with everyone else, for a really beautiful presentation this morning. I wanted to ask you about a project that CLU is working on, and it is a demonstration project for the jail, which will be a different facility based on, I visited the Norway prison, which is the most humane prison in the world, and this last summer, and so there is a group in Santa Barbara that's really working on, hey, could we bring that kind of jail to Santa Barbara, at least as a demonstration model, because we've spent $80 million in the last 8 years, and we're still increasing recidivism. So something's missing, and it's what you talked about this morning. It's that sense of community and that sense of a common humanness that once you get in the jail environment is just totally missing for as long as you're there, and it's kind of wasted time. And so we're looking at what they do is once you're behind the locked wall, everything else inside is for rehabilitation. And the guards are trained for 2 years to be able to help you achieve your goal, your unique path to get outside the jail and not return ever again. And whatever you need, their job is... Anyway, it's very exciting. But the question, one of the questions that came up is the racism within the jail. And so our demonstration project would reflect the real world, which is a mixture. But they separate the people currently in the jail because of violence and so on. So my question to you is, if we would definitely have to have this demonstration model combined and be a real reflection of the jail population and how this model can work. The guards don't have guns, and it's just a totally different model. But how would you go about the... I know you know I've worked with you on the criminal justice system and the element of racism that's involved in the whole mix. How would you... how would you construct your ideal incarceration system where there would not be, or there would be some kind of training and some kind of experience that would form community among interracial groups, which is like the most far out extreme thing that could possibly happen now?
Wow. So the horrors of incarcerated experience are symptomatic of our society. And and I'm glad you brought up communion again, because we need communion. We need a common meal. When, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, you probably saw in the news a hashtag, Oscar's so white, you know, because, you know, there had been so many years in succession with no awardees who were non-white. So it kind of was a protest thing. And in the following year, things had changed because they diversified the academy itself. And without a diversification of anything, you're going to have issues. So I was really not that upset about Oscar So White, because there are a lot of other things that are so white. Silicon Valley So White. Yeah, Wall Street So White. U.S. Senate So White. You know, I mean, there's just so many things that are so white, but to me, the one that I take issue with the most is church so white. Because it allows, I mean, without dealing with matters of conscience, it allows people who live in Silicon Valley or, you know, near Wall Street or Madison Avenue or wherever to feel okay with it. You go to church, it's not dealt with, they're not experiencing anything different at church than they are in their workplace. And because of that, I feel like the church is more complicit in sustaining racism than any other institution, because we are the people of we are the conscience of society. You know, we don't look for Wall Street to be the conscience. Believe me, they're not nothing of the sort. So, if church life was mutually there was mutual engagement and respect, then it would change. I think it would be a conscience to society and speak to the criminal justice system, jury makeups, who gets a job as district attorney, all of these kinds of things. If there were more opportunities, openings, and recognition of the skills and the talents of people of color, I think that would do more to reduce the prison population and change the prison world more than anything.
I guess I'm very fortunate that I haven't had any deaths in my immediate family for some years, and so what tends to keep me awake at night is greed and cruelty. And so the subject, and I think the Serenity Prayer is truly profound, and I try to remember that, but the subject has come up here on several occasions, how to balance some sort of a contemplative life with a life of action or activism. And I just wonder if you have any insights into that. I mean, I'm sure you do.
Yeah, I think it's easy to burn out if you don't have spiritual practice, because the problems are too great, the opposition is too strong, and the sluggishness of even allies is disconcerting. So you need a connectivity that goes beyond the visual and the audible, which you need more. And I say this as a person who has a little history in activism. I went to Ferguson. I was in Columbia, Missouri, maybe 4 years ago, when the African American students set up a tent city in the middle of campus and said that they were fed up with the way their school was treating them, and had a long list of demands that nobody thought was going to happen. Top of the list was the resignation of the president of the university, and I was there when he resigned. I spent some time at Standing Rock. I'm at most of the things that are local, you know, where it's a climate action or whatever it might be. And just the little that I do can be exhausting. And it's expensive, because nobody pays you to do that. Contrary to the talking points that say George Soros is paying the bills, I'm still waiting for my Standing Rock check. It's expensive. It affects your lifestyle. You have sometimes to decide whether you're going to go on a vacation or go and stand up for people, to go stand up with people like Adie Bark in the Senate or whatever. People have to make decisions. Activists have to make decisions along these lines. And the only thing that's going to sustain us is more of God's presence in our lives. More connectivity to that. So, I don't see how we can go on without maintaining our lives. Thank you for that question.
One last thing here. I sense a real interest in the contents of your trunk. Do you have any more books in your trunk, and would you go get them and bring them in? I'm sure that people read it in How to Make America Great Again.
Sure.
All right, thank you.
I will do that. I'm parked on the far end, but I'll drive my car around and pull out some books. They're $20. They're all hardcover.
I went to St. Louis University. That was in 1952. I'm aging myself. But that was when the school had just become to be integrated. And there weren't that many black kids there at the time, but they were always sitting by themselves in the dining room. And I was sitting by myself, and I always wanted to join them, but it was in a very welcoming situation because they weren't comfortable. And we were back to a reunion about 15 or 20 years ago, and I asked the tour director, how about integration at the school now? Has it changed? And she really didn't understand what I was talking about. So I don't know if it's changed that much. And I was really disappointed that she couldn't answer the question. But I have to say that I did attend a mass at our Religious Education Congress also years ago. And it was attended by black people and celebrated, I think, by a black priest. And I was the only white person there. So, yeah, things switch around. And I loved it. I loved it because everybody held hands and they swayed to the music. Their whole bodies were celebrating, and I highly recommend it. So I want to know where your church is and what the name is. Can you tell me again the name of your church?
New Covenant Church.
New Covenant, and it's on State Street?
821 State,
821
9
State
a.m.
Street. So come one, come all. I think you'll enjoy it.
Thank you for the plug. You know, I have been integrating just like Ruby Bridges in the Norman Rockwell painting when she was, that's been my experience in California. I was the only black person in my kindergarten class in San Francisco. And then I was the only black person in my school at that time. It doesn't look like that now, but Oxnard was not as brown as it is now. And I was at Brittell School, the only black person in the school. And junior high was more diverse, high school. But I'm also part of a generation of African Americans. Most of us who went to college are the first people to go to college in our families. Some went, some had the means to go to historically black private schools, but it wasn't that easy to pull off. And so my dad enters his bachelor's degree at UCSB 20 years after I did. And I thought that was, you know, pretty amazing. So I know what it's like to be an integrator and to basically, I'm kind of bilingual because I can understand things and, you know, and interpret. there was a point I was going to get to from there and I forgot. You know that stage. Yeah. So we're out of time. Okay. God bless you all. Thank you. Much love to you.
Thank you, David. So happy to have you here. Can't wait till you come back.